Hello, everyone. Thank you for watching The Naturalist Capitalist. I am your host, Reed Coverdale. And on the other end today, we've got Harrison Kemp. Some of you guys might know who he is. He's an associate with Free Speech Media. He's a veteran. He's a libertarian. He's an author. He's done all sorts of cool stuff. He's gotten a no-knock raid ban passed through the House unanimously in Maine. So he's here to talk about some of that. But how you doing, Harrison?
I'm awesome, Reed. So happy to finally be here. You know, you and I have been kind of working together for a few months now, so it's cool to finally get to chop it up with you.
Yeah, let's just start out with that, actually, before we get into your story. You were one of the founders of Free Speech Media, I think, right? You and, man, I'm spacing on his name right now. He's been out of the chat for a while.
Roger.
Roger, yeah. You and Roger started it, right?
Yeah, so Roger and I started Free Speech Media on January 29th of this year with the idea of basically having the liberty movement, but in media, and really uniting the liberty movement through media. So the idea was to have the entire libertarian spectrum represented, which is why we've got AMCAPs, we've got LibSox, we've got minarchists of every stripe. And so we really represent what up until very recently was the kind of the entire body of the LP.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll be talking about that with the LP. But I mean, it seems like we've mostly gotten along. There's been a few moments when there was a little bit of turmoil, but the Free Speech Media crew seems to not hate each other for the most part. We seem to kind of pull it off.
Yeah, it's weird. We have people who completely disagree on very important things, both philosophically, policy-wise, and just as far as the party runs. But yet, it never really divulges into this, well, I hate you, you're a cuck, you know. It's always just kind of, well, we disagree. I guess we'll have to do a podcast about it sometime. So that's pretty neat to see people who completely disagree settling their stuff in long form conversations rather than in comment sections. And I think it's helped. I mean, well, you know, I'd say I think it helped, but then all of this New Hampshire stuff started and caused the fallout now that we have to deal with. So I guess we weren't able to get here quite soon enough to keep everything tied together, but I hope that we'll be able to be part of the healing process at least.
It seems like a necessary step that has to be taken, though. I mean, at least in my opinion, from what I've seen happening, there are some bad actors and some crooks who've been exposed. And I mean, you can't have that. You can't work with parasites. You have to remove them. You know, like this whole thing about purging that everyone's worried about. You do have to purge bad actors. You don't have to purge people who disagree with you on strategy or might disagree with you a little bit on different views or whatever, but people who are deliberately working against other people and trashing them and also like systemically doing screwed up things in the party, like that's something you've got to deal with. You can't just let it slide. So even though this sucks, it's something we kind of have to do, in my opinion at least.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It sucks, but we do have to do it, because when you have people who are fighting the growth that's coming into the party, when you have people who aren't able to work with other libertarians because of personal biases, it makes it very difficult for us to actually do our job, which is fighting the state. Our job is fighting the greatest empire the world's ever known. It's not giving each other purity tests at every turn. So that's why I'm very excited to be running for Region 8 rep and to be running as the alternate in the meantime, because I think we need to heal. And the only way that we can heal is to get back to work. When we're fighting against the state and we're passing legislation, we're training lobbyists, we're getting door knockers out there, we don't have time to focus on this petty stuff because we're busy working. So if I was going to have a slogan, it would be, let's get back to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's so funny that people want to protect their dynasty in this joke of a movement that it is right now. Because let's be honest, like, I mean, I want it to turn into something, but right now it's kind of a joke. And if you care about protecting your turf, that kind of says a lot about the rest of your life, I guess. Like, if you think that whatever amount of credence you have in the Liberty movement is worth being a shitbag over, then you probably don't have very interesting things going on in the rest of your life.
That's very true. I mean, if I lost my positions as, you know, main state vice chair, if I was unable to continue doing any of this lobbying that I do, if nobody ever bought another book from me, I have other things I enjoy. You know, I love reading. I still like to write, even if nobody's reading it. Like, I have other things that bring me joy, and it would really suck. Like, I'm not going to lie, you know, because I care about this movement. So yeah. If I got told by the body, hey, we don't like you anymore, we don't want you here, that would really suck, because I devote all of my time to this. I am full time in the Liberty movement. But if it's the free market, if nobody's buying what I'm selling, if nobody likes what I'm doing, if they don't think I'm doing it productively, then I need to take the hint and I need to go on to other things. You know, I need to go back to sales. I need to go back to, you know, landscaping or whatever it may be. So yeah, yeah. I think it's inevitable that purges occur within organizations and that shifts occur. You know, shifts have occurred within every political party. They've always adapted and moved forward. And what we're seeing right now within the LP, from what I can see, is just a lot of people claiming and hoping for that they can retain their position within a social organization. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really what this has become, is a social group. And I've told my board here in Maine plenty of times, hey, I love you guys, I want to talk to you, but when we get together for our XCOM meetings, that isn't the time to chit chat about personal stuff. It's time to work. You know, we can chit chat about personal stuff afterward, and we do plenty of time. We have very good friendly relationships, but we also need to work. And I feel like a lot of what this has turned into, because we are so small, is that it's people who are friends because they've been doing this stuff together for years and years together. So they've built up a relationship, and now that they see everything they've worked towards is being taken over, it's being moved in a way that is not at their control, and they're reacting to it. And it's apparent they're not acting in the best interest of what the majority of the members of the party want. And as much as libertarians, we hate democracy, this is a voluntary organization where we've all agreed that the majority rules. So I think that, yes, this is inevitable. I think that within a year, we're going to be back to business, and this is all just going to have been a big blip in the road. We're going to have another 25 elected libertarians across the country at the state level, and it's just, we're all going to move on and it'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about the the voluntary organization thing. Because I hear that when people say, well, you know, we don't believe in democracy, so you can't apply that here. It's like, well, no, I mean, we don't believe in democracy through statism. We don't think that, you know, unjust force is somehow justified because more people want it than don't want it. So if more people decide that, you know, it's okay to, you know, hang gay people or something, so what? It doesn't matter if more people think that. It doesn't make it okay. But if you're voluntarily joining an organization, you have to play by the rules. It's like if you're going to play a chess game with someone and you just say, oh, laws, those don't mean anything. Like, who, some guy made the laws to chess however many years ago. That doesn't have any effect over me. It's like, well, okay, if you want to play, it does. You know, like if you want to be involved in this. So yeah, that's an obvious distinction there. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you're a veteran. How long have you been a libertarian? Was that influenced by your time in the service, or just give us your political story?
Yeah, so I kind of grew up apolitical. You know, my family was kind of conservative, but we never really talked about politics around the kids. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of grew up wanting to play football, and that was all I cared about. And then I joined the Army because my mother was in the Navy. So I felt like I kind of had this obligation to follow the family tradition, because I had a bunch of family that was in the military, and I was still in that statist warmonger mindset of they attacked us because they hate our freedoms.
Right.
And that obviously that's changed over time, but I joined the military. I became a heavy equipment operator. I was lucky enough to not have to engage in combat. I was able to actually bring thousands of Marines home by destroying one of their bases. That was part of what my crew did over in Afghanistan. Was it was called CRME, I think it is, if I'm remembering it correctly, but basically we were part of the retrograde mission that was reducing the troop numbers in Afghanistan at the time. So before I was an anti-war activist, I was doing anti-war stuff. And then came home, got out of the military. I was just kind of done with it. I wasn't like an anti-statist. I wasn't anti-war. I just was done with it. Got out, started getting more interested in politics. And because, like I said, my family comes from more of a conservative background, they were like, oh, Trump this, Trump that. Plus, I'm a veteran. And it's like, this is part of the reason I don't like identity politics, is because it's like, I'm a veteran, therefore I have to vote for a Republican. Mm-hmm. And so I understand identity politics when someone says, hey, I'm part of a downtrodden group, I'm part of a minority, and this person is coming here and speaking to me and giving us hope. But veterans are just sitting there going, well, I'm a vet, therefore I have to vote for a Republican because that's what we do. And so I bought into that mindset, and I didn't actually vote in 2016, but I was all gung-ho with the memes for Donald Trump. And then I moved home, I started going to college, and ironically, while I was going to college, I stumbled across the name Ludwig von Mises, and that was kind of it. You know, from there, I stumbled down the rabbit hole into Austrian economics, which led me to the Mises Institute. And at some point in there too, I was kind of in what you'd call like conspiracy comedy. Like Dave Smith has a friend, for instance, his name's Sam Tripoli. He does this conspiracy comedy podcast. It's hilarious. Mm-hmm. But they were talking about the Federal Reserve one day, and they brought up a book by Murray Rothbard. And I bought the book, not even being libertarian yet. So I bought this book, The Origins of the Federal Reserve. And that was one of the first ones I had ever read that kind of brought me in. Then in, I want to say it was like 2018, I started doing podcasting and writing a blog, just kind of because that was when I was first really diving deep into libertarian philosophy and the economics and whatnot. So I was kind of podcasting and blogging just so I could work this stuff out in my head. It wasn't even for an audience. It was just for me. So that way I could have a better understanding of it. And I also had this idea back then too, that one day I was going to run for office, because I had all these really good philosophy that I wanted to implement. I had all these actions I knew I could do because I was really into legal history. I was really into the Constitution. I knew what was and wasn't constitutional. And in my head, I was like, if I could just get in there, I could make a difference. Well, then you kind of realize the behemoth that is the state, and eventually you realize you can't really make a difference by just being a rep. There's a lot of other things you have to do and that you can do. And so that's when I got more interested in agorism. I got more interested in the withdrawal strategy. And ever since then, I've kind of been implementing all of them together. Like I get involved in politics, but I also don't pay taxes. I go to agoras and farmers markets as much as possible. And so it's like, it doesn't have to be this binary decision that a lot of people make it out to be. And so that's kind of been my transition. I found the Mises Institute and went from there. And then one day Michael Heiss had put out on the Mises Caucus page, hey, I need an organizer in Maine. And I was like, well, you know, screw it, I'll do it. And that was how I got into the LP. If it wasn't for that, I would have got here eventually, but It was really the call to action. You know, we need somebody who can get to work and start doing stuff. And that was what motivated me to finally get in. And I just haven't stopped working since.
Yeah. Where in Maine do you live anyway? I'm from New Hampshire. So originally.
Yeah. Right now I live in Old Town. I'll be moving back down to Brunswick at some point in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you like Maine? I like Maine. It's like, I don't know. Everything's just slower there. That was always how I felt. Yeah. You know, when, I mean, New Hampshire is not bad either, but man, when you go to Maine, everything's just laid back. The people are just more chill. The drivers aren't as retarded, you know, especially as they are in Massachusetts or Southern New Hampshire. It's just, I don't know. I like the way that people are there more.
Yeah. It's the way life should be. That's right. Our slogan. And you know, it's after today, I'm going to say, so they just passed this new bill here in the House where, or I think it actually passed the Senate today, where now, no matter how many drugs you get caught with, it's $100 fine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can pay the $100 fine, that's it. You're golden goose. And then if you can't, you have to go to some kind of rehab, mm-hmm. which is a huge improvement from we're going to lock you up in a fucking cage and right. throw you in there for years and years and years. So, I mean, I would prefer it to be a $0 fine and not even we're going to bother you. Right. But this is the gradualism that Ron Paul was talking about. You have to get people on board in small steps, and then it allows you to take bigger steps. You know, we get this bill passed right now. We keep a lot of innocent, peaceful people out of jail for years and years. And maybe what we can even do as the as like a libertarian organization, maybe this is something a party would want to do, is raise funds, like raise hundreds of dollars. So that way, every time someone gets arrested for that, we can be like, hey, here's your $100. You know, we're going to pay your fee so you don't have to go and do this this training here, this rehab. And that's something, if we truly believe in drug legalization, we're getting there. But it's incremental.
Yeah, it's so funny. I think a lot of Ron Paul fans are out of step with Ron Paul. You know, like a lot of them that I talk to, at least, are very anti-coalition. They're very anti-incrementalism. They just want to be bold and they want to see immediate things. Like, they're all or nothing. And man, was Ron Paul ever not that. I mean, he was as principled as you can be, but he understood that he wasn't going to reach his goal tomorrow. I mean, he was in right. the House for what, 20 years? Like, how much do you think he saw happen in the House?
Yeah.
And he was always working with people who disagreed with him on a ton of issues. As long as there was this one thing you could find in common, he would reach out and get it done with somebody. And that, I mean, people just don't. I don't, a lot of Ron Paul people don't think like Ron Paul did, which I just find kind of funny.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's funny because I actually wasn't around for the Ron Paul revolution in 2008 and 2012. I just wasn't into politics back then. I was 16 in 2008 and I was in the army in 2012, getting ready to go to Afghanistan. I just wasn't into politics. So when I got out, it was kind of like, oh, there's this guy who's saying some sensible things. What? Where did he go? Why isn't he running anymore? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I kind of came after the wave, but I was still pumped. Like, I'll watch Ron Paul debate videos. I'll watch the Giuliani moment when I'm feeling down and out. And I'm like, oh, man, this is a hard fight. And then you just watch someone saying, well, you know, I believe the CIA when they say there's unintended consequences and we got to worry about blowback.
Right.
It's like, yes. So, yeah, I think you're right, though. We, a lot of people, a lot of the Ron Paul kids have not followed this. Let's focus on the things that we agree on and put the things we disagree on the side. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that if it wasn't for doing that, we never would have got our no-knock bill even sponsored here in Maine in the first place, because my original sponsor is a Democrat who, she's a very nice, wonderful person, but she's a hardcore leftist, you know? And so we focused on the things we agreed on, police reform, and then later on, we can discuss the things we disagree on. Like, we were able to have a very honest and open discussion in which I told her we should abolish the minimum wage, and she allowed me to actually explain in depth what I meant.
Right.
She wasn't just, oh, you hate poor people. She was like, well, how would that help people? And I went into it, and she just kept asking inquisitive question after inquisitive question. but it was only because originally we focused on the things we agreed on. And later we could have a conversation, not a debate, about the things we disagreed on. So, yeah, you're right. And that's one thing I've really tried to do. And if it wasn't for doing that, FSM wouldn't exist. I think everybody in our little group has been great at putting their personal stuff aside and really working for the betterment of the group.
Yeah. So talk about your books you've written. What do the books really go into, and when did you write them? How long did it take you to do each one? And you're writing one right now, correct?
Yes. So I've got two books out and I'm working on my third right now. My first book is A Parasite's Paradise, which I was on Shane Hazel's show not long ago and talking about that. He called it a classic and a must read if anybody is interested. So this book, basically, I tell the story of Erwin Schiff. I tell the story of Duncan Lemp, of George Floyd, of the Federal Reserve, of income taxes. Basically, what I go into is a whole lot of libertarian theory and philosophy and real American legal history that you're not going to get taught in school. But I put it all into this fake story. So it's what I call factional. It's factual fiction because there's so much of it that's just accurate, where we talk about how Erwin Schiff was killed for not paying income taxes. We talk about how Duncan Lemp was just gunned down for a very minor infraction, if there was even one. We talk about how, basically at the end of the day, the state is there to serve itself. And I create this dystopian where, you know, quote unquote normies will be able to read this book and they go, man, I couldn't imagine living in that society. Yeah. And then the final 10 pages, I break it all down and I tell you the truth. Hey, this is, you know, Paul Krugman, of course, is in the book, as is Mises. But I'm like, hey, this is who Paul Krugman is and what he thinks. This is who Mises was. This is who Rothbard was. This is who Herbert Dow and Duncan Lemp. And I go through all of these important people. So that way you actually get a history lesson. You know, I talk about the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. And I teach it to you in a way that you have never learned it before, if you've ever even heard of it. And then my second book it's called The Brief Inquiry into the Causes and Solutions Surrounding Homelessness, where I basically take a free market Austro-libertarian approach to ending the homelessness crisis. And I say, one of the biggest issues is the minimum wage, and I give many reasons for it. You know, employers don't want to hire someone with a unreliable track record of work. They don't want to give somebody who doesn't have an address a job or a phone number a job, somebody who doesn't shower regularly because they don't have access to one. So all of those things just price people out of the labor market. And of course, there are going to be people who are too physically or mentally handicapped to work. That's always going to be a case. There'll be some people who just cannot take care of themselves. But as long as we are able to allow those people who can take care of themselves to get back to work, reduce the amount of assistance they need, we can actually target what limited resources we have through charities and through, you know, heck, and I extend an olive branch, through even the amount of funding that we use now, by targeting it more, we would have greater results and actually solve this problem. If we eliminate the minimum wage, if we adjust zoning laws, adjust property taxes, eliminate all these compensatory taxes that are out there. So I also go through a bunch of different thought experiments and whatnot. So that's what those are. I basically, in one book, I write the normie version of libertarian theory and history. And then in the next, I go into a little bit more of an introductory intellectual thought experiment on how we can solve one of our really, really big socioeconomic problems that we have right now.
And what's your current book you're writing about?
So right now, the working title is Closing Freedom, A Sales Guide for Today's Liberty Activist. So basically what I'm doing is taking my sales experience and my knowledge of libertarianism and tying those two things together. And I'm giving you email scripts, phone scripts. I'm giving you the best ways to talk about other caucuses. So that way, when somebody's like, well, you know, I agree with libertarians, but this thing, you can be like, oh, great. There's this group of libertarians who don't agree with all libertarians on that thing either. Here's your home. Or they could be like, well, I'm really into gun rights. It's like, great. There's a whole caucus for that. You know, there's a whole coalition just for that. So mm-hmm. we can teach you how to plug and place people. So that way we can actually grow this movement and turn it out of this whole like, well, you're not my kind of libertarian, so therefore go fuck yourself, but turn it more into, well, hey, you're a libertarian. Let's find out what's important to you. What are your skill sets? What do you bring to the team? So that way, if you want to be an active member of the team, we can plug you there. So that way you have the greatest effect. And so that's what I'm going through. That's really the point of that book. I've got a bunch of different lines, a bunch of different closings, a bunch of different ways for you to make money off of fundraising. And it's really all practical stuff. You know, it's kind of dry textbooky stuff, but it's one of those books that you don't have to necessarily go through and read line by line. You can say, all right, I'm working on fundraising this week. I'm going to go to the fundraising chapter and just read through that. Or, man, I really need to send out this fundraise, this email on an event we have. Let me go to that section and see how to do that. So it's going to be a bigger book, probably about 300 pages, but it's one that you can just kind of go to the section you need. And at some point, I'll hopefully be able to get an audiobook version of that out as well. And I've got a GoFundMe for that. So make sure you buy my books. And if you want, you can support my latest book on GoFundMe. And you get all kinds of goodies. You know, you get signed books and thank you in the acknowledgement sections, those types of things. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people only think about libertarianism or the lifestyle of liberty during election years, where for a lot of us, we kind of live independently anyways. Like, all, I mean, I've done it before I even joined the Libertarian Party. You know, I save money, I would buy things with cash, I would try to stay out of the banking system as much as possible. I didn't take out student loans. I just kind of got everything on my own, you know, through work. Like, I got paid to get skills instead of taking loans out for tens of thousands of dollars in college degrees and then trying to pay it back. And then, you know, try to help my friends out. They could borrow money from me instead of borrowing money from a bank. You know, I grew up with parents who gardened, and we grew our own food a lot of the time. And we had friends who'd go hunting, and they would give us meat. And I don't know, like, for a lot of people, it's just part of life. And I think a lot of them don't even realize that they're contributing to liberty in that way. You know what I mean? Like, they don't really realize that they're actually starving the state in a way. So it's kind of cool that you have a book that kind of talks about that and kind of open people's eyes to that and make them realize that, oh, wow, this is really an effective thing I can do. Not just posting things on the internet or just checking a box on an election day. You know, there are things I can do in my own life to make a difference.
Yeah, there are a lot of things people can do in their own life to make a difference. If you don't want to pay taxes, this isn't legal advice, so don't come suing me, but it's not hard to write the word exempt on your tax sheet. It's mm-hmm. not hard to go to a farmer's market. It's not hard to pay cash, like you said.
Right.
And there are a lot of these little things you can do. For instance, here in Maine, you can buy a firearm that's under a 50 cal and you don't have to register it. You know, you don't have to get an extra background check versus what the state gives you or versus what the FBI gives you. And if you buy a private sale, you don't have to do anything. So right. There are a lot of ways, especially in a state like this, where you can really take advantage and live your best, most free life. And that's what I think everyone should do. And whether you want to be involved in politics or not, politics is going to be involved in you unless you get way out into the middle of nowhere. And
they'll find you eventually, even out there. So
yeah. And I'm not saying that the LP is or is always going to be the best route. You know, it's always an ebb and flow, and it's always going to depend on your region and who are the better candidates in your region. You know, if you've got some guy who's running on the LP ticket who's a bum, but then you've got some guy who's running on the Republican or Democrat ticket who's like literally the world's greatest libertarian, but they're running somewhere else. I mean, it's not to say that you should, you know, I'm not giving anyone advice. I'm just saying that there is no one answer. There's no one answer. And anyone who tells you that you have to vote for this group or that group, all they want to do is control you, just like the state wants to control you. You know, you don't have to vote for Dick Cheney. You don't have to vote for anyone. And that's really the simplest way to break it down is you don't owe anyone aside from yourself your allegiance. You owe only yourself. And until your kids are able to take care of themselves, you don't owe anyone a thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The Libertarian Party is a vehicle. That's all it is. It's not. I mean, I've talked about this for months, pretty much since I got involved, you know, a year ago, that I don't care if the Libertarian Party becomes a nationwide force and becomes the number one party in the country, because if it becomes a statist organization and starts moving away from its values and then achieves that, then we haven't achieved anything. To me, it's all about liberty. And whether that's through agorism or through political involvement or secession, whatever it is, I don't care, as long as we're moving toward liberty. And what I've come to realize recently is you're always brought up with this mindset that you want the country to come together and you want the country to heal and you want liberty throughout the entire country, which I do. I would love liberty throughout the entire country. But what I'm realizing is it doesn't matter so much as long as I can achieve liberty in certain places. Like, if people don't want liberty, as long as they're not infringing on other people's rights, I've realized that's okay. Like, if Massachusetts wants to become a communist state, as long as people can leave and we don't have to deal with them, like, I don't care. Like, I don't need to change their minds. It's more about trying to get the liberty-minded people to be able to reach people who are susceptible to our message and who would want to work with us and who would want to create an environment in that way. So things like the Free State Project, you know, I'm becoming much more sympathetic toward that idea, or Greater Idaho or Texit, you know, all these things. I think all those ideas are great, instead of this approach that we need to reform the whole country and save it. You know, I don't know if that's even realistic. So,
yeah, I don't think saving the whole country is realistic, because everywhere is going to want to organize itself differently. And to the extent that libertarians believe in government, they believe it should be small and invasive and local. And so I don't think that it makes sense for us to go around saying, well, we want to, you know, make the entire United States live by these exact policies, when those policies are antithetical to what large swaths of people believe in and would willingly pay for if they were able to. So I think the real move is secession. Let's start getting out of this giant amalgamation that we have, which was supposed to have been just a simple contract. You know, the contract that the states signed to become a part of the union, they should be able to leave at any time. If you can willfully sign a contract, you can willfully leave it. There is no date of expiration, and they are clearly allowed to secede. And that's one thing that I've actually started trying to kind of play out in my head, because that's a future project, is writing a book on how Maine could actually secede, how it could actually function. You know, how would healthcare work? How would the transit systems work? How would our National Guard work? How would pulling out of all the federal programs work? And I tell you what, it is a lot of work just to think about it, because we are so intertwined with the federal government at every level. The federal government is in control of how your toilet flushes. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work that we have to do. And I think we just have to kind of appreciate the small steps. And it's like Harry Brown said in his book, How to Find Freedom in an Unfree World. If you have to first be happy and free in your own life, that doesn't mean getting rid of all responsibility. Excuse me. But it means making sure that the responsibilities you have in your own life are ones that you want to be a part of. You know, like, you're not doing things because you're pressured by society to do them. You're not working some job you absolutely hate and going home every day miserable. But, and then you're like, we need to end the state because without a state, we'd all be happy. Miserable, you're miserable because you're working a crappy job. So there are a lot of things we need to do to get ourselves right too, that affect how we go about fighting the state. So,
yeah, I agree. Multilateral approach, basically. And so many people look at different approaches as opposition. And in my mind, as long as you're not obstructing other people from their approaches and you're not just being a parasite and trying to stop them, if you're in a different lane, as long as we're all moving in the same direction, I don't care, you know? Yeah, so we touched on it a little bit, but let's go into a little more detail about your run for Region 8. What are you hoping to accomplish? When does that really start? Have you already, you've already announced, so I'm assuming you've got a website already up, and are you what's the process from here on out with that?
Yeah, if people want to learn more about me, learn more about my projects, my blog, and all that fun stuff, you can go to harrisonkemp.com. But no, I don't have a website particularly set up for my Region 8 alt run. But yes, I have officially announced. I am looking forward to that. It's kind of already in the process. I don't know when our chairs will be voting on it, but it'll be sometime soon, I assume. So basically, my plan is to try and unite all 8 of our states and get everybody on the same page, start doing some bi-monthly training events so that way we can all learn how to write legislation, we can learn how to lobby, we can learn how to phone bank, we can share this information between each other, because we have some really experienced people in our region, and then we have some really inexperienced people. And it's a shame that they aren't in better communication. So that's something I'd like to facilitate, is that type of training. And I would also like to really bring a little bit more representation into the representative spot, where before I go vote on something that's going to affect my entire region, I know I've heard and spoke to everybody in my region. Or at least I have made as much of an effort as reasonably possible to reach out to everyone. And so that way I know I'm representing my region. And if it comes down to one of those, well, 4 people want it, 4 people don't, at that point I'll interject my personal opinion. But until then, I feel like a representative's job is to represent the will of the people they represent. And that is why Tucker unfortunately ended up stepping down, is because he felt as though he couldn't do that anymore. And I really want to say that I appreciate Tucker doing that. I appreciate him saying, I don't feel as though I can represent you, and therefore I'm going to willfully step down. Because if I was ever in that position, that's what I would do. If I ever felt like I couldn't represent the body I was elected to, I would step down. I think that's the only appropriate thing to do. So yeah, I'm going for LNC Region 8 rep, and I'm looking forward to representing all of these states, really trying to get this back on track and make it so busy that we don't have time to fight.
You still there? Okay.
Yeah, can you hear me? All right. Yeah,
I thought you froze. It cut you off right before you ended. So you were saying...
Oh, I was saying that... Yeah, basically, I want to make it so that we're so busy working, getting stuff done, that we don't have time to fight amongst each other. You know, we have time to strategize, we have time to plan, but we don't have time to fight, we don't have time to bicker. And I really think that Rich Bowman, who's now the region rep there, he's going to do a great job. But from everything I've heard of him, he's somebody who I would be very happy and proud to work under and learn from. So I think that if I was elected to that position, I would bring the same force that I brought to the main LP and helped us grow and help to really facilitate a system where new members are able to come in and move into leadership positions and grow their county affiliates and I look forward to doing the same thing on a larger level.
Yeah, I'd love to see you, my friend Jeremy Todd, Shane Hazel, and Joshua Smith all in there representing different parts of the country. That'd be great. yeah, is there anything else you want to bring up or discuss before we end? Or
I guess I really got – that was it, man. I'm very busy, but that was 42 minutes of what I got going on. So
yeah,
I would say make sure you check out Free Speech Media. You know, go to facebook.com/freespeechmedia. We have awesome libertarian content streaming 7 days a week from all across the libertarian spectrum. So if you want to support my latest book, you know, I've got a GoFundMe going for that. And then pick up my other two books. They're both on Amazon Prime. You can pick those up for $14.40 plus tax delivered to your house. And yeah, that's it, man. So much stuff going on, but that's it.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on, man. I'm glad we finally had the time for a discussion. As we were discussing, you know, I've been in Free Speech Media, I think, since March, and had a couple conversations, but finally got to sit down and talk, so it's good. It's cool being part of the team. I'm actually going to get to meet a bunch of you guys in a few days at Pork Fest, so that'll be fun.
I didn't know you were coming. That's awesome.
Oh, I am. Yeah, I'll be there. I know I'll be there Thursday and Friday. I don't know when else yet, but I know I'll be there Thursday night and Friday.
Do you need a place to stay?
Not sure yet. I'm going to work on that. My dad's going to go up with me, and we're old vagabonds, so we'll figure something out if push comes to shove, but we'll see.
Free Speech Media is at site 163, so everybody make sure you come say hi and read. If you need somewhere to stay, you can come hang out with the team for the night. So,
okay. Well, there you go.
We've got
insurance. But yeah, I've got a bunch of links in the description where you guys can go follow Harrison's stuff. You can follow him on Twitter, and then he's got his websites plugged there. And yeah, looking forward to meeting you, man.
You too. I will see you next week, man. I'm excited about that.
Yeah. All right. I'll see you there.
All righty.